warm welcome to everyone listening to episode 3 of the 36 Stone International Arbitration Hot Takes podcast. This is part of a series of informal conversations between the barristers at 36 Stone and their guests from the international arbitration community. My name is Ravi Aswani, and I'm delighted to have as my guest today Louise Woods, partner in the London office of Vinson and Elkins, specialising in dispute resolution, and Vice President of Arbitral Women. Welcome, Louise.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Ravi. It's great to be here, and I'm really pleased to have been asked to join.
Likewise, there's so many things I'd like to ask you, Louise, and we've got a lot to go through. So let's start somewhere near the beginning. How, when, and why did you decide that a career in the law was something for you?
Well, that's an interesting question. I probably can't pinpoint an exact time frame, but I would say by about the age of 15. So I should probably back up a little bit. I moved around a lot as a child. My father's job took us to various different countries and continents. And when I was about 7, we moved to Boston, Massachusetts. And our next door neighbor was a criminal defense attorney who has become a very dear family friend. And he was sort of like an uncle to me and to my younger brother. And he seemed to live this very glamorous lifestyle of disappearing off into Boston to do his lawyering. And he drove a Lexus and he was always taking us to the ballet and the opera. And I sort of looked at him and I thought, this sounds, you know, this sounds like something that I could enjoy. And on top of that, I think he always had some really fun stories to tell about his days. And, you know, I mean, some of them were just hilarious. One in particular stuck in my mind. He represented the Boston Strangler. I don't know if you recall that story, but he said he was particularly nervy at that time. And he had taken someone out on a date in an Italian restaurant in Boston, as you do. And the waiter came at him from the corner of his eye with what looked like a giant baseball bat. And it turned out it was one of those giant pepper grinders. And so he just instinctively turned around and tried to wrestle this pepper grinder from the waiter who was coming at him. But he was always full of stories like that because I think he dealt with characters that meant that he was always sort of looking over his shoulder. Anyway, a million miles from what I actually do today, but I think that's what set me on the course for law. And so, yeah, I'd say from about the age of 15.
And I know you didn't study law at university, you studied English. Did you know at the time you chose your subject that you wanted to end up, if all went well with your plan, as a lawyer?
Yes, I made the conscious decision actually to study a non-law degree. After we lived in Boston, we moved to Paris and I did all of my secondary school education in Paris. So I'd had a very sort of French teenage upbringing. And I wanted to come back to the UK to go to university. And my best subject and my favorite subject was English. And so it seemed right to me that I come back to the UK and I went to UCL, where I believe you went as well, Ravi.
Yes.
And I did English there, always with the intention of converting to law afterwards. But it just seemed to me, you know, why not do something that you know you're good at and you know you enjoy? And there's plenty of time to sort of think about your career after that. So that's what I did.
Yes, and it's something we see more and more of. I think when I qualified, it wasn't an unknown thing for someone to become a lawyer or at least a barrister without having a law degree. But it's certainly becoming more and more common now, especially in the kind of work we do. We see a lot of people with language-based qualifications who are now doing very, very well because of the international nature of what we do. And I think as a profession, we've moved beyond this rigid notion that you have to study law in order to be a good lawyer.
I think that's absolutely right. And we see it more and more with the vacation scheme students that apply to Vinson and Elkins. More often than not, they will have a non-law degree. And, you know, why not? You've got a very long career ahead of you. Why not study something else for a few years? And, I mean, as you say, that there are transferable skills in arts and sciences degrees that lend themselves very well to a career in law, and particularly, I think, to a career in international arbitration.
I'd certainly second that. And speaking about international arbitration, Did you know when you decided on the law that dispute resolution and international arbitration in particular was where you'd want to end up, or did that come much later?
Funnily enough, that came later, although I think my parents and my husband now would probably say I should have known I was going to be a disputes lawyer, because that's how I'm wired. No, I paralegaled for a couple of years before I started my training contract, and I did so in a derivatives and financial regulation team. So I had significant finance experience when I started as a trainee. And the firm I trained at, Salins, which no longer exists, it merged with S&R Denton a few years back to become Dentons. They gave me a first seat in finance as well. I think they liked the idea that I would know what I was doing in a finance seat, having paralegaled there. And then my second seat was a finance secondment. And so by the time I was a year into my training contract, I'd basically done more than 2 years of finance. And I think I just decided that's probably where I would end up. And despite doing a fourth seat in litigation, it didn't really turn my head. And in September, when I qualified, I was offered a finance position, which I gladly took. But then, of course, Lehman Brothers collapsed, and there wasn't really a whole lot of finance work to do. So I ended up being asked by the firm if I would sit temporarily in the litigation department because, funnily enough, they had more work than they knew what to do with. And so that was sort of a 3 month stint, which became a 6 month stint. And then when I was a year post qualification, we sort of mutually agreed that if I wanted to stay in litigation, I could do that. And that's what I chose because I think by then I'd learned to love it. And I think one thing I would say to sort of current trainees is very often I don't think a litigation or an arbitration seat as a trainee is necessarily reflective of everything that a career in disputes has to offer in the longer term. I certainly didn't have that experience.
Yeah, I would second that. You only get a snapshot of the lifestyle from a limited period of observation like that. And there are things which obviously you only pick up on the job, as it were. If I may say so, Louise, you've achieved partnership at a relatively young age. You've still got plenty of years, decades left of your career. How do you hope your career path will develop in the next 10 years?
Well, aside from early retirement, no, I'm kidding. Well, first of all, thank you. It's a very good question, and I think as an associate, I was always striving for partnership. I mean, I just knew I wanted it, and I think if I looked at my peers, we often would discuss, where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? And some would say partnership, but not all. But I was very clear that that's what I wanted, and funnily enough, I think once you achieve that, it's almost like being a newly qualified lawyer again. You sort of get to the top of one mountain and you just find that you're at the bottom of the next. And there's a lot to learn. And suddenly you feel out of your depth again. And I think, and this may be a particularly female characteristic, but I think that was my initial feeling was sort of having gone from a fairly experienced associate to suddenly a newly qualified partner, and it was a challenge, but I think there is a lot to learn still and a lot of growing to do. And I suppose my aim for now is to continue to grow as a partner and to grow my practice and my client base. I wouldn't rule out something else in the future. I going in-house for the right opportunity possibly one day, but it's not something I'm focused on any time in the immediate future.
Might we see Louise Woods increasingly sitting as a member of arbitral tribunals?
Absolutely. I would love to increasingly do that, definitely. And I think that's one of the great things about our career is that you can sit on both sides of the table, shall we say. So yes, I would love to do that. And I mean, on a personal note as well, I really enjoy the sort of mentoring and nurturing of younger female talent that my current position enables me to do.
Yes, well, I know about that from personal experience and other things we've done, and I'm really keen on asking you a few more questions on that topic a bit later. But before we move away from the career aspects we're discussing now, If you had to reflect today, what would be your one particular career highlight or notable case so far?
Ooh, that's a very difficult question because there's so many to choose from, and obviously there are so many different strands to one's career. But I think the Alwarak versus Indonesia investment treaty case that I had stands out for me as a particularly noteworthy case. That was a case in which we acted for a Saudi investor who'd invested in Indonesia. And sadly, his investment had not gone well. And so we represented him in arbitration against Indonesia. And the reason it stands out in particular is that we used a then little known agreement called the OIC agreement, which had never been the subject of an investor state arbitration at that point in time. And we were successful in establishing jurisdiction under that treaty. Essentially, we persuaded the tribunal that Mr. Alwarak, as an individual investor, had standing to bring arbitration against the state of Indonesia. And that was quite a big deal at the time, and I think I was quite proud of my involvement in that, not least because Mr. Alwarak personally, I became very close to him over the number of years that we worked together, and he had a very compelling story to tell. And actually, that case stands out for more reasons than just that one. In a sort of pre-COVID time when virtual hearings and remote hearings were few and far between, we had several instances in that case that called for, shall we say, technological advances to be made. So we had one witness who was in prison in Indonesia at the time and had to give his evidence from his prison cell via video link. So that was very interesting. And we also had a situation in which Mr. Alwarak, our client, couldn't actually travel to the hearing himself to be present and to give evidence and to be able to give us his instructions because of an outstanding Interpol red notice against him and the risk that he would be extradited to Indonesia. So he was actually at home in Saudi and he joined his own hearing via video link from there. So I'm going back a few years now, and I think we had at least three or four different cameras set up in the hearing room. It was all very exciting.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Louise.
That reminds me of another incident to do with Indonesia, which I'm sure many of our listeners will be familiar with, but let's not digress. I'd really like to go back to nurturing the female talent of the future, which you mentioned, and specifically your work with arbitral women. I'm sure most listening to this podcast will be familiar with arbitral women, but for those who may not be, could you perhaps in a nutshell just tell us a little bit about the organisation?
Absolutely, I'd be happy to. So Arbitral Women is a non-profit organisation for the promotion of women and diversity more generally in international arbitration. It was founded approximately 30 years ago by two women, Louise Barrington and Mireille Philippe, who are still extremely involved in the organization. And we have grown now to have a membership base across more than 40 countries, and I think we have over 1,000 members. So we're very proud of that. And what do we do? Well, as the name suggests, really, we look to promote and to support and to advance women practicing in international dispute resolution. And we do that by offering a network that enables women to promote their own brands and to connect with other women in practice. But we also offer mentoring, both career mentoring and a separate parental mentorship scheme, which focuses on the transition in and out of the workplace around parenthood and parental leave. And we have various other schemes as well. We support MOOT, the VisMOOT. We send teams to the VisMOOT. And we generally assist by providing directories that clients and counsel can consult when they're looking for arbitration practitioners, both counsel and arbitrators. It's a great, great organization to be involved with. So, yes, I hope that gives you a helpful overview.
Yeah, and I'd be really interested to know, why did you want to get involved and how did your involvement first come about?
Well, I'd love to say I wanted to get involved selflessly, but I think it was actually rather selfish. At the time, so I think I'm going back to around 2009, 2010, I worked in a disputes team where all of the partners were men, so there were no sort of senior female role models to look up to, bar one fantastic senior associate, a woman called Sophie Palmer, who's now at Dentons, with whom I'm still great friends. And she suggested to me at the time that if I wanted to build a network in arbitration, then I needed to join Arbitral Women, and that was the place to meet senior women in arbitration. And so I did. I took her advice. I joined the organization and I volunteered to assist. They have many committees. They do a lot of work, all of it volunteer work. And one of their committees, the newsletter committee, produces a newsletter every couple of months, which highlights all of the members' achievements and their news and spotlights various members for those achievements and contains interviews, etc. And I volunteered to help the newsletter committee with their work, and that's where my involvement sort of grew from.
I think there's a wonderful lesson right there for all junior practitioners listening. You started off as an outsider, you volunteered to help, you've been helping, and now you're vice president of the organisation. It just goes to show you never know where these things are going to lead, do you?
I think that's absolutely right. And I actually mentor two individuals through the Arbitral Women Mentoring Scheme. And one of them actually recently asked me how they could get more involved and more plugged into the arbitration community. And I suggested, I gave the example of how I'd approached the newsletter committee at Arbitral Women and asked if I could help. And I suggested she do very, very similar with Arbitral Women or with other organizations and use that as a platform to build her profile. And absolutely, my experience is that it will help you grow your brand and your profile, but also you make fantastic connections and you have no idea where they'll take you in future. It's really worth the investment.
I completely second that advice, Louise, completely. What I'd like to do now, if I may, is to broaden the debate to include other diversity initiatives. If I could maybe just spend a minute or two giving some context for this, and then I'd love to hear your views. Diversity initiatives usually start with gender, and as you mentioned, Arbitral Women has been going strong for nearly 30 years now. You know from previous discussions we have had that I'm a huge fan of Arbitral Women and the great work it does, including the groundbreaking parental leave mentoring you mentioned earlier. I remember attending an Arbitral Women event on parental mentoring here in London at Jones Day in November of 2017, and it really stands out in my memory as one of the best events I've ever been to. The Equal Representation in Arbitration pledge recently celebrated its 5th anniversary and has inspired other pledges for different diversity initiatives. I would be the last person to suggest that the work on gender diversity is complete. Clearly, it's not, and there is no room for complacency. At the same time, though, we shouldn't be shy about celebrating success when it happens, and we have seen a degree of success. We are seeing tangible results. Year on year, we see improvements in the gender diversity statistics reported by the arbitral institutions. The LCIA, in its recent 2020 annual casework report, for example, reported a further incremental increase in proportion of female arbitrators appointed at 33%, up from 29% in 2019, and we see similar trends with the other institutions. That said, there is some evidence to suggest that to date, the principal beneficiaries of diversity initiatives have been more senior white women. You will recall from 2018 a famous article published by Global Arbitration Review, which posed as its headline the question of whether the legacy of the Equal Representation in Arbitration pledge would be that arbitrators would end up being pale, stale, and female, addressing this very phenomenon. And it is a phenomenon that we see in other fields as well. This article and many other things have helped contribute to a more subtle and sophisticated debate, and I think it's wonderful that we are now having this wider debate. Jackie van Hersholt van Hoff, Director General of the LCIA, who was instrumental in setting up the Equal Representation in Arbitration pledge, always says when she speaks about it that they had to start somewhere, and as relatively low-hanging fruit, gender diversity was the logical starting point, but the plan was always to expand outwards from gender diversity. Taking a step back, where we seem to have reached in 2021 is a position where there is widespread recognition that diversity is more than gender diversity. To give a few examples, there is also racial diversity, geographical diversity, LGBTQ plus diversity, and of course, intersectional diversity considerations where people may identify with two or more of such aspects of diversity. Are these things that Arbitral Women discusses and has a position on?
Very much so. At Arbitral Women, we're conscious of the progress that's been made with regard to gender diversity. But we're also extremely conscious of the continued need for improvement, not just in terms of gender diversity, but all forms of diversity. And it's now thankfully accepted that diverse groups produce better results and that all forms of diversity therefore benefit all of us. Frankly, more needs to be done to achieve gender parity on tribunals in international arbitration, and there really is no excuse for us not having achieved that to date. So yes, to answer your question, at Arbitral Women, in recent years, we've seen more of a focus on other forms of diversity as well, racial, socioeconomic, geographical, to name but a few. And we're very conscious to ensure that we take those other forms of diversity into account when creating and pushing out our initiatives and rolling out our programmes.
So I'll give you one concrete example, which is, you know, it's not particularly exciting, but we get a lot of requests at Arbitral Women for sponsorship of events. So other institutions, other committees and organizations will ask us to co-sponsor events with them. And we will interrogate the panel of speakers, for example, the list that we're given, not just for gender diversity or gender equality, but also for other forms of diversity. So we are very much focused on that. There's a lot more to do, and I do worry that, you know, people might stagnate or become a little bit lazy if they think there's gender diversity on a panel. You know, do we need to look any further? And the message at Arbitral Women is absolutely you do. There is a lot more work to be done. And we do try and take it into account in everything that we do. For example, our sponsorship, our sort of Vismoot sponsorship, where we look at teams that we're willing to sponsor, we look for geographic diversity as well. And in fact, amongst our board of directors at Arbitral Women, we strive for geographic diversity as well. So yes, very much on the agenda.
At the bar in particular, one of the things which we've been focusing attention on in recent years is social mobility. And this can be a minefield, even for the most clued up and well-meaning of people trying to tackle it, because any initiatives inevitably are involving generalisations, sometimes sweeping ones. To an extent, I suppose that's inevitable. It goes without saying that social mobility considerations potentially can apply across the board. At the risk of oversimplification and generalisation, what we see is that ethnic minority candidates appear to be particularly affected, and of all ethnic minority candidates, it appears to be black candidates who are most affected. We have had a massive problem historically at the bar in recruiting and retaining talented black barristers. There is absolutely no shortage of talented black aspiring barristers. We just don't see them practicing at the bar in the numbers we should. The figures across the bar in general are not great, but I'm afraid to say that the problem is particularly acute and obvious at the commercial bar.
Do you see anything similar in the solicitor's branch of the profession?
I do, and I think much like you've just described, it is particularly acute in the sort of commercial or in the city firms. And I do think it's something that requires a lot of effort and attention to address. And, you know, I think we are all accountable, those of us that have positions that give us an influence or the ability to influence the hiring decisions, the retention decisions and the promotion decisions, to be working to do more about this. And I'm certainly working with our graduate recruitment team within Vincent and Elkins to help improve access to our vacation scheme for students who might not otherwise have got there. And one of the things that we are doing at the moment is we have a school's outreach program with a school in a deprived area of East London, specifically aimed at improving those social mobility statistics. So I think it's incumbent on all of us, and I think we suffer from exactly the same problem that you've described, although perhaps not as acutely as at the bar.
One thing we're trying to do at Chambers, and I'm pleased to say that we're slightly ahead of the curve, perhaps, compared to the bar generally on this, is that in our last round of pupillage selection, we redacted from the paper sift information which would reveal the candidate's name, but also their university. Now, this is something not at all free from controversy, and it took a lot of debate internally before we decided that this was something we were prepared to do. Because, as I mentioned earlier, it's a blunt tool which does involve, on one view, some sweeping generalizations. But statistically, the numbers don't lie. They generalize, but they don't lie. And, for example, having a Russell Group university as a scoring criterion, it could be said, favours applicants from a private school background or from state school backgrounds where they have particularly good careers advice and mentoring so that they have interview practice, etc., etc. Some people would say that if taken to its extreme, this is a form of social engineering, which it is not the role of the professions to do. Others would say that if the professions do not take a stance and implement affirmative action, then nothing will ever change. I don't think there's a right answer on social mobility. It's very tough, but do you have any views on that type of attempt to deal with the application procedure in that way?
That is an interesting one. We don't actually do that at the moment where we anonymise CVs. But we have formed a recruiting subcommittee of our Diversity and Inclusion Committee, who now look through our vacation scheme and training contract application forms. They do a sort of second level review and look to identify anyone whose background or journey seems particularly deserving of another look. They do a sort of second level review and they will pull out anyone whose background or whose journey stands out as being particularly sort of deserving of another look. So, for example, in a situation like the one you described, where perhaps they have overcome some form of hardship and found themselves at a well-known Russell Group university and are perhaps sort of more impressive than the candidate who got to the same end point but through a private school education, for example. So we are looking at things like that. It is very difficult to do that, and one has to be careful about the assumptions one is making, whatever those assumptions are. And I don't know what the answer is, and you know, it's a very big challenge, I think, for employers today, generally.
Yes, it certainly is a challenge today, isn't it? What you described, that's, I think, called contextual recruitment, and we had a conversation in Chambers about whether we went the full way to doing that, but we weren't quite ready in this cycle to do so. As you say, it requires a lot of work because inevitably you end up making assumptions, all well-meaning, because you're trying to achieve something which ultimately everyone agrees is something desirable. But I think it's something which at least is on the agenda and people are aware they have to grapple with now.
We've also had training around interviewing, for example, because, you know, the law is a strange profession where people who are not trained in people management or in recruitment find themselves managing people and recruiting people. And so I'll be the first to say that we're not the best people to be doing that sort of job, but such is life in a law firm, and perhaps at the bar as well. But we've had this type of training, and one of the things that really stood out to me was the idea that you need to set the criteria, so the specific criteria that you are looking for out of a candidate need to be set in advance amongst the team of people who will be interviewing or looking at applications, because this minimizes the risk that someone goes into an interview and comes out and says, oh, I just, you know, I can't explain it, I can't describe it, but they have it, or I think they'd fit. I think studies have shown that having that approach to things allows your implicit biases, mm-hmm. your sort of gut feeling to take over. And because we all know that people like to, they are comfortable with what they know, and they like to sort of recruit or appoint in their own image, that you need to set these criteria in order to challenge yourself and hold yourself to account, and hopefully reduce the instances in which that sort of thing happens. So I found that particularly interesting.
Yes, I'm sure many of our listeners will have heard of affinity bias, which is what you are describing, and is a particularly problematic type of unconscious bias. Historically, I have to say we have had big issues with affinity bias at the bar. Likewise, we have had some interview training on this, and I suppose it's obvious when someone sits you down and tells you about this. Perhaps we can end this section of our discussion just by referring to the Harvard University website. If there's anyone who thinks they're not biased or would like to find out just how biased they are, if you Google unconscious bias Harvard test, you'll very quickly find a seminal test which you can take. It was devised some time back now, but I think anyone who's taken that test is always surprised by the findings that it yields. Let's move on, Louise, to the pandemic. The diversity initiatives we've been talking about, do you think they've been affected in any way, positively or negatively, by the pandemic?
That's a very interesting question. I think it's probably too early to say definitively, because we're still living through it. But I'd probably be annoying here and sit on the fence and say both. I think there have been some positive changes. The fact that I can dial into conference calls until 7:30 p.m. and then step up from my desk and walk into the kitchen and sit down with the family for dinner is definitely a positive. And I think that more often than not, the women I speak to who are now homeworking as a result of the pandemic will all say that they found benefits, increased family time, for example, less of a commute, to be a plus side for the remote working environment that's come out of the pandemic. But I think equally, you know, there have been downsides. It's much harder, I think, if you are relatively junior, to build up new contacts and grow a profile from scratch in this remote environment than it is if you're a senior and you already have contacts. You and I, for example, know each other reasonably well. It's quite easy to pick up the phone and to reach out and to have a virtual coffee. I'm not sure the same could be said if you were trying to make contact initially with someone. And so I think the more junior you are, perhaps the more challenging that would be. And as we all know, that tends predominantly to affect women who are still not as represented higher up in the profession. So I think it can go both ways. Another benefit, I suppose, is the ability to dial into conferences and seminars all over the world without incurring travel fees and without taking time out of family life to travel. That's definitely a bonus. And I think we're seeing more and more attendance at things like London International Disputes Week or Paris Arbitration Week, by people who are, you know, on the opposite side of the world, because it's much, much easier to do so now than it would have been a year, 18 months ago.
I certainly agree with that. And one of the things I hope which lasts when we make a return to in-person conferences is hybrid offerings, because I have met so many people during and conferences online and afterwards in the virtual networking who come from jurisdictions where the culture, the business model, the way of working just doesn't allow them to take a week or 10 days away, travel to the other side of the world at the firm's expense and attend in person. And it's so important that we level the playing field in the community and allow everyone to participate and become a member of the community. So I hope that one is something that we see. You spoke about events happening virtually and not having to travel. There's, of course, a climate change aspect to that as well. Could I ask you, what are your views on the campaign for greener arbitrations? And indeed, have your recent arbitrations been greener?
Of course. Well, I mean, I think it's a great campaign. And a couple of Arbitral Women board members and former board members are heavily involved. So it's close to home. And I fully support the initiative. As to your question about my arbitrations, definitely. I have done all of my hearings remotely since the pandemic started, bar one. And they have all gone remarkably smoothly. And I see no reason in future why, certainly for procedural hearings where there isn't the question of live evidence, why they couldn't go ahead remotely.
I would second that. My experience has been similar. I think once everyone got over the novelty and the fear of the unknown, actually most things have been able to take place, and they've done so very efficiently. Have you had any notable cat filter or similar incidents you can share with us, Louise?
Oh, I still laugh about that cat filter now. I sometimes I just have to go and look at it again. Just brightens up a dreary Monday. Nothing so good as the cat filter, thankfully. We did have one Court of Appeal hearing that was done remotely. And I'll just say that one of the justices of appeal was having trouble connecting and thought that everything was on mute when it wasn't. And there was a rather hilarious moment with lots of swearing. So everyone was chuckling about that. But no, nothing quite so good as a cat filter.
Yes, well, I can share with you, we had an arbitration, and we would always be able to keep our time very efficiently, because pretty much at 11 o'clock on the dot, the arbitrator's dog would start barking, and it would be because the postman had arrived. So that was a moment of light relief in an otherwise very difficult and hard-fought case.
It's definitely not my postman. He's never on time.
I don't think our postman comes at 11 either, come to think of it. Are you back in the office at all now, Louise?
No, not yet, actually. Our office remains officially closed, although we are able to sort of go in if needs be, but it's not actively being encouraged. I think the view is that the risk is reduced if everybody works from home as much as possible. Having said that, we are starting our vacation scheme this week, and that is taking place in person. So over the course of the summer, I will be going in at various points to support the vacation scheme students and to check in on them and see how they're doing. So I'm very much looking forward to that. I think it's time for a change of scenery. I'll just keep it at that.
Yeah, and going forwards and looking at things in a more long-term perspective, assuming this time next year we're not all talking about the Epsilon variant, where would you like to be working from in the main?
Ooh, well, I've thought about this and I've spoken to others about this, and I think for me it's 3-2. And I think I've settled on 3 days in the office, 2 days at home. I think that would be my ideal. As I think I said earlier, I'm definitely enjoying the additional time I get with the children. My children are quite young, so they go to bed quite early. And in normal times, I wouldn't see them in the evenings after work because of the commute home. So that's definitely something I'd like to continue 2 days a week. But at the same time, nothing beats sitting down with your colleagues face to face and also just having that change of scenery and just a different place. I find I miss the office, actually.
I agree with you completely. The quality of my family life, my time with my children and even with my wife, has improved a lot over the past year and a half. And it's something I wouldn't just want to unthinkingly abandon by going back to long hours in the office every day, day in, day out. I suppose it's just a question of a happy medium, which will be slightly different for everyone. But let's hope that we're all in a position to at least make some return sooner rather than later. Let me ask you this, Louise, now, if I may. I'm always interested in how people feel when they reflect on their own career journeys. So before I ask in more general terms, which I will in a moment, more specifically, what advice do you think the Louise Woods of 2021 would give the Louise Woods of 2001, if she could?
Well, I would definitely tell her to enjoy the fact that she can drink more than two glasses of wine on a weeknight and still get up in the morning and deal with whatever the day throws at her.
Yes, indeed.
But on a more serious note, I think I would probably tell myself, you know, you've got this. Just believe in yourself and keep doing what you're doing. I think so much of my energy, perhaps, was spent worrying about whether I was good enough. And again, I don't know if that's particularly a female trait. I know that, you know, we hear about the imposter syndrome a lot in the context of women in the workplace. But I think just, you know, looking back now and knowing that I did the best I could to achieve what I wanted to achieve and succeeded, I think I'd just go back to myself and say, look, just, you know, relax. You can do this.
You've got this. I think that's awesome advice, Louise. And I think that that's great for our more junior listeners to be hearing from someone like you. I agree. I think as lawyers in particular, we're all prone to judging ourselves much more harshly than we would judge anybody else. And as you say, it can be a particular problem when people experience imposter syndrome. I think it's now studied and documented that it's a particular problem which women experience. They underrate themselves, certainly more statistically than men underrate themselves.
Indeed, it could be said of some men that they suffer from the opposite problem.
But really,
I'm glad you said it.
I can, so I will. I think the lesson is we really just should all just be a bit more gentle and kind with ourselves. But it's really, it comes down to that, doesn't it? Let me ask you more generally then, what would be your three top tips for aspiring international arbitration practitioners?
This is interesting. So I was having a discussion with one of my mentees recently who's just starting out in international arbitration. She has had a previous career and is just turning to arbitration now. And I think I reflected on this with her. I think the first tip I would say is read as much as you can about the current developments in international arbitration. So much about arbitration is written about and published, and whether that's, you know, current procedural updates or issues, policy issues, the interplay with politics, particularly in the context of investor-state arbitration, I would just read as much as you can, because I think it pays to know your stuff. And I think more perhaps than other areas of disputes, international arbitration is talked about and moves quite quickly. So that would be my first tip, because I think with knowledge comes confidence. So the more that you know, the more confident you will be and come across. And I think that will help you. Second one I'd probably say is be sociable. As exhausted as you might be on a Tuesday night after a long day at work, make the effort to go to the drinks, to the networking event, to join the webinar or the seminar, because you will get to know people. You come across the same names time and time again, and eventually they'll become friends and colleagues, and it pays to know people. And you and I know that. We met over drinks many, many moons ago.
Yes, indeed.
Pretty sure there were drinks involved.
Yes.
So yes, my second tip would be sociable. And I think finally I'd say just, you know, carpe diem, seize every opportunity, seize the day, seize every opportunity that comes your way. You know, no matter how terrified you might be, I remember the first time I actually ever did any live advocacy in a hearing, the partner I was working with said to me the night before, I think you should handle cross-examination for this witness tomorrow. And I don't think I slept a wink. It was absolutely terrifying. And I felt I was going to be sick the whole way through. But I made myself do it. I took the opportunity that was given to me. And I'm so glad that I did. And so I think, you know, I would encourage people to do that as well.
Again, those are brilliant tips. Thanks so much, Louise. Speaking for myself, I've certainly had to work hard over the years on not talking myself out of daunting but rewarding opportunities. I'll never forget reading somewhere a quote that your excuse just gave someone else their opportunity, and that's really stayed with me ever since. And I've tried to live by that maxim a bit more since reading it. We're reaching the near the end of our time, Louise, and we discussed before today that before ending, it might be fun if we swapped roles for a moment or two and have you ask me a few questions. So please fire away.
Great. I've been looking forward to this. So what I wanted to ask you about, first of all, is mentoring. We both share a passion for mentoring and the role that mentoring can play in helping to improve diversity in international arbitration. Did you have a mentor, official or otherwise, as a junior arbitration practitioner? If so, how do you think that helped you early in your career? And if not, what do you wish a mentor could have done for you?
In a nutshell, the answer to the first part of your question is no, Louise. Formal mentoring wasn't really very established during my formative years, and so no official mentor as such. But I'd agree with you on the value of such schemes. I've been a buddy in the Young ICA mentoring program in two cycles now, and I only wish that such programs had been in place 20 years ago when I was starting out, because I can see the really tangible value they have for young practitioners, in particular cross-generational and cross-jurisdictional exchange of ideas and best practice. Unofficially, though, it's different. The bar as a whole has a good track record in terms of looking after its junior practitioners and younger entrants into the profession. And so it's always been something I've been able to do, call people when we were in the building physically, pop my head around someone's door, ask questions, etc., etc. But I think that in the international arbitration sphere in particular, there's a real sense of community, which you don't necessarily find in all areas of practice. You've already made some reference to this. And what I started doing many years ago, realizing I had nothing to lose, albeit that I did it with some trepidation, was I started approaching people. I started almost cold calling and emailing people saying, I heard you speak at this conference, or we know each other from whatever it may be. Would you mind at all if I had 5 minutes of your time? I'd really like to ask you something. And to my surprise, people by and large say yes. And if they don't, I mean, the worst that can happen is you get ignored, but you're no worse off than you were before. Or someone might say, sorry, I'm really busy, can you email me back in 3 months or whatever it may be. But by and large, people have said yes. And I've learned so much in this kind of unofficial, organic way, little nuggets of wisdom from senior people across the years. And I don't think I'm ever going to forget that kindness that people have showed me. And so I make it a point that if anyone ever approaches me, I try to pay it forward. I think we're all obliged really to do that because we've had the benefit ourselves.
That's such a nice thought, to pay it forward. I like that. So we talked earlier about tips for aspiring practitioners. And as someone who trained at the bar and who regularly sits as arbitrator and deputy district judge, I'm sure you'll have seen and heard many different advocates over the years, some from a common law background and others perhaps from a civil law background. I'd love to hear your views on what makes a really effective advocate. And I'm going to be taking notes here.
Okay. Well, it would probably take me a separate podcast to give you a comprehensive answer, Louise. So let me try and give you three brief pointers. Firstly, written advocacy. We've got a problem with written advocacy in international arbitration. It's just getting more and more verbose. And it's probably a lost cause now. I think we've gone too far. But ideally, we need a massive reset. Probably it would be going too far to impose page limits or outlaw footnotes, which in an ideal world is what I would do. But I do think advocates should sometimes remember how they're helping or not helping a tribunal by putting in a piece of written advocacy. And as I always tell my pupils, written advocacy in all its forms should ideally not be repetitive or contain anything surplus to requirements. And it's amazing how many very, very, very good advocates you see in practice not always follow this. Second, and this is a tip I always give to students when I'm arbitrating in the Wismut and other competitions, is tell a persuasive story. I think this is an aspect of legal practice which is completely neglected in legal education, because in most jurisdictions we end up teaching students directly or indirectly that the practice of law is all about black letter law. But as practitioners, you and I know that's just not true. 9 out of 10 cases will turn on the facts, not the latest Supreme Court decision on a particular point. And if you tell a persuasive story, even if you don't necessarily have the strongest case, it can be quite compelling advocacy for a tribunal to hear. Thirdly, I would say don't underestimate the importance of cultural sensitivity. I have a story which I'll tell you, and I've heard other people tell similar stories as well. But I was once involved in an arbitration as counsel, not arbitrator, against a rather old school senior QC on the other side, in front of 3 Asian arbitrators seated in Singapore. I think we were only instructed because the contract itself was governed by English law. But anyway, there were certain issues of a certain Asian jurisdiction's foreign law, which was addressed on both sides by very senior professors. And I should say that the arbitrators and the professors were from civil law jurisdictions in Asia, probably not as accustomed to adversarial cross-examination in the way that lawyers from a common law background would be. And to my surprise, the old school QC cross-examined as if he were sitting in the IDRC in front of a panel of 3 other old school QCs. And I could see the tribunal visibly getting more and more uncomfortable at his treatment of this very senior and eminent professor. When the professor and all 3 arbitrators came from a legal tradition where such people would be shown some degree of deference. And that's not to say the cross-examination couldn't have been done, but the style was completely wrong. And although we lost on this particular case, on this occasion, notably we won on this point of foreign law, and I think the tribunal went out of its way to make that clear in the award, I think the arguments on this question were very, very finely balanced. And to this day, I am convinced it was his inappropriate approach which tipped it in my client's favour. And so I suppose there's a fourth point really there, in addition to the cultural sensitivity, is don't underestimate the fine margins which cases are sometimes decided on. And little things like this, you never know, might make a difference.
I think that's so true. And I think we've all probably got a story where we've seen what we would consider perhaps inappropriate or ill-judged advocacy in that type of situation. Because let's not forget, international arbitration brings together legal practitioners from all different backgrounds in a way that many other areas of law don't. And so I think the opportunities to sort of see that tension play out are exacerbated. So I think that's very good advice. And on your first point about written advocacy needing to be concise, I couldn't agree more. My heart sinks when I receive something and there's, you know, 1,000 footnotes and 400 and something exhibits, and you just think, really? Did you not have time to write something a little bit shorter?
I think that's often the problem, isn't it?
Yes, but no, I think that's a good one. And of course, telling a persuasive story. I mean, I think the art of advocacy is about storytelling as well. So great tips there. Thank you very much. So I've got one more question for you.
Yeah, please.
Do you think we arbitration practitioners are going to get back to business as usual soon? Or do you think the way that we've practiced has changed for good as a result of the pandemic?
That's a very good question, Louise, and I think people will answer it differently based on their experiences. But I think personally it's more of the latter rather than the former, i.e. the way we practice has probably changed for good. And 2 specific points occur to me. The first is, I think virtual hearings are here to stay now. Obviously there will be certain hearings where one or both parties wants a traditional in-person hearing, but what we've learned is that virtual hearings work very, very well, and they're not going to just fade away when the pandemic does. If anything, I think there's a risk that documents-only proceedings are going to be an unintended victim of the success of virtual hearings, because in so many marginal cases where the costs of a hearing in person, a traditional hearing, are not warranted, traditionally there would have been a documents-only solution as the only viable alternative. But now, with a virtual hearing cheaper, I think that may be something which we see a lot more of. And secondly, this goes back to something we discussed earlier, In-person conferences will make a return, and I very much look forward to the day that they do. But for the reasons already discussed, I think the hybrid format is something which must stay, and we should all encourage, whenever we can, conference organisers to keep going with that particular format, because it's really enabled people who haven't had a look into the international arbitration conference scene to see what it's all about now. And I think we've gone too far. We can't now snatch that opportunity away from them. We'd be doing everyone a massive disservice. So I think hybrid conferences now are going to be something which we see much, much more of.
I think you may be right, and I'd probably agree on both counts. I've certainly seen the success of virtual hearings, as I mentioned earlier, and in the context of improving diversity in arbitration, I think the hybrid conferences are great. So thank you. Well, that's great. I've enjoyed asking you the questions.
And certainly I've enjoyed asking you my questions, Louise, and really fascinated to hear your answers. We've managed to cover so much today, and I'm really so grateful for your candid and considered responses to my questions. It's really been a pleasure to do this podcast with you, so thanks again, and I know our listeners are going to love it.
No, thank you. Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you.